Ever since Turkey's Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, was formed in 1978, it has relentlessly pursued its goal of an independent Kurdistan, often resorting to violence. Joining me now to explain the current conflict between the PKK and the Turkish government is Aliza Marcus. She reported on the PKK for more than 8 years, and now she's written Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, which is published by NYU Press. I'm very pleased to welcome her to today's edition of Backstory. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is the PKK primarily a Turkish party, or do they have a presence throughout the region?
They have a presence throughout the region, but they're fighting for Turkey's Kurds. That's what they say. But they do have an offshoot party, an Iranian Kurdish party, that's fighting the Iranian regime for greater Kurdish rights there.
But Turkey is the main focus because over half of the 28 million Kurds live in Turkey?
Turkey is their primary focus, and it's really where all their attention and rebels are focused.
Are they all in the same part of Turkey, or are they spread out across the country?
The Kurds are spread out throughout Turkey, although the majority of them are based in southeast Turkey, which is right near the Iraqi border.
And independent Kurdistan would include parts of Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. Do the Kurdish minorities in those countries have better relationships with the governments than the Kurdish minority has in Turkey?
It's hard to say better or worse. They all have very different ones. Right now, of course, in Iraqi Kurdistan, the Iraqi Kurds have autonomy, a type of federation. In Syria, the Kurds aren't really recognized as a minority. They have a lot of trouble in terms of learning their language, identifying themselves as Kurds. In Iran, similarly. In Turkey, their situation is mixed. Right now, they do have a pro-Kurdish party, but Kurds still feel very much like their identity and any sort of nationalist desires are oppressed.
Now, since there would be, if there was such a thing as a Kurdistan, it would take up parts of all those different countries. But the different countries are handling them differently. Do they relate to the PKK differently?
You know, Kurds in each country have, at times, they fought together, but for the most part, they fought for a Kurdistan in their own part of the region. So although the PKK officially was fighting for a greater Kurdistan, or that was its goal, it really was fighting for an independent state inside Turkey.
Is there a PKK presence in Iraq? I think you said there is, but I mean, how are they regarded in Iraq? Are they considered the dominant Kurdish political movement, or are they a fringe group?
No, right now the PKK uses Iraq, northern Iraq specifically, the Kurdish part of Iraq, as a base to launch attacks against Turkey. PKK rebels are pretty far from the main cities there in the population centers. Mm-hmm. They're in the mountains, and they don't really mix that much with the Iraqi Kurds.
Aren't there other Kurdish parties in Turkey?
There are, but they're basically ineffective and very small. For many years, the PKK worked very hard to wipe out its rivals, often killing them. And so pretty much you have the PKK as the only illegal rebel group fighting for the Kurds, and then you have a pro-Kurdish party which contains whose members, many of the members sympathize with the PKK.
Where do the PKK get this? So this is kind of like the IRA,
yes,
in Northern Ireland, where there was a political arm and then it was a military arm, and the two sometimes worked together and sometimes had disagreements?
Yes, but it's a little different in that the Kurdish party inside Turkey denies any real link with the PKK. In fact, many of its members are sympathetic. Some of its members have served prison terms for being actually members of the PKK, but they say officially that they're separate from the rebel group.
Where does the PKK get its funds?
It gets its funds from extorting money from businesses in Europe, from the exiled Turkish and Kurdish communities there. It also controls the smuggling routes on the Iranian-Iraqi-Turkish border. So they'll take money from people who smuggle animals, who bring goods across, who bring drugs across. And they do get donations from sympathizers as well.
Now, that's pretty similar to what other groups of this sort do. It's similar to what the Basques do in Spain, the IRA in Northern Ireland. Is there kind of an international sensibility of these groups that are trying to establish independent countries?
I think they all use, you know, as you say, they all use the same means. You know, they have magazines, they extort money, they do this, they run small businesses. I think the way that these groups operate is pretty similar, but they, you know, they don't really have links between themselves because they're fighting very different fights. They don't even share a language usually.
Does the cooperation of Iraqi Kurdistan pose a problem for the Kurds when they deal with the U.S. government, or is Kurdistan the least of the U.S. military's problems in Iraq?
Well, from the perspective of the U.S., it really is the least of its problems, but right now Turkey is making it one of the biggest problems because Turkey is threatening to invade northern Iraq to kick out PKK rebels, or to try to kick out PKK rebels, and they want U.S. backing to do this. And the United States, of course, doesn't have the manpower to send up there to help the Turks, nor do they want to, because they're very busy in the rest of Iraq. And frankly, the U.S. realizes that dislodging the PKK rebels from those mountains is near impossible. If it was possible, Turkey would have done it years ago, because Turkey has sent troops across that border many, many times.
Doesn't the United States also appreciate the problems that the PKK gives to the Iranian government?
The United States, of course, has to be very careful on this because the PKK is officially a terrorist group for the United States and for much of Europe. I think it's pretty clear that the United States is not upset that the PKK has a side organization that's making trouble for Iran. But really, this group is killing a few dozen Iranian Revolutionary Guards, but it's not about to topple the regime.
My guest is Aliza Marcus, who's written a book about the PKK called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, published by NYU Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, what impact did the American-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 have on the Kurdish situation in Turkey?
The U.S. invasion helped create an Iraqi Kurdish state, basically a mini state. Right now it's an autonomous region, but it appears to act like a little mini state. And what this did was, for Turkish Kurds, it really inflamed their nationalist desires. It gave them an example of what they might want. All they have to do now is look across the border and they can see an autonomous Kurdish region, and now they have a real political example. And this was exactly what Turkey was always afraid of. It was afraid that Kurds in one part of the region would gain broad national rights, and that this would cause problems with its own Kurdish population, and it's done just that.
Wouldn't the Kurds be better served by simply going into Iraq and creating a greater Kurdistan?
The Turkish Kurds and Iraqi Kurds have good relations, and many of them are linked by family or tribe or business, but the fact is that Turkish Kurds want a solution in Turkey. That's where they've lived for centuries. That's where their families are, their businesses. They don't want to just move to northern Iraq and set up there. They want an answer in their own region.
And by the way, wasn't Saladin the great leader of the Muslim cause during the Crusades a Kurd?
Yes, he was, and Kurds are very proud of him, even if he didn't create a Kurdish state as such.
But how does the rest of Islam deal with that? Do they just simply ignore that fact?
Because they basically ignore that fact. It's something that's known, but they see him more as an Islamic leader than a Kurdish nationalist.
And what was going on in the late 1970s that led the PKK to establish itself?
In the 1970s, there were a lot of armed Turkish leftist groups that were active inside Turkey, and Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the Turkish Kurdish rebel group, he came out of the Turkish left. And he and friends of his were interested in a Kurdish state. They had been exposed to what was going on in the region in Iraq. The Iraqi Kurds were fighting for a state. But they realized they couldn't find an answer within the Turkish left. The Turkish left just wasn't interested in this question of Kurdish nationalism. So they broke off and they formed their own group. And interestingly enough, in the late 1970s, mainly they fought rivals. The PKK was more interested in killing off its rivals than it was actually fighting the Turkish state. But later on, it turned its attention to the Turkish state.
We mentioned earlier the IRA and the Basque separatists, etc. What about Hezbollah and Hamas, who also are active in this region? Have they had any connections to PKK?
No, the PKK actually used to have connections with Yasser Arafat's Fatah and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, headed by Nayef Hawatma, who's based in Damascus now. These groups actually trained the PKK rebels in the early 1980s in Lebanon. There was a military coup in Turkey in 1980, and many people fled Turkey, not just Kurds, but Turks. And they came to Syria looking for support or sanctuary. And what Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the Turkish Kurdish rebels, decided to do was try to get training from Palestinian guerrillas, which, by the way, is something that many leftists were doing from Germany, from Cyprus. Pretty much if you were a leftist who wanted military training in the late 1970s, early 80s, you went to Lebanon. And he did get training, and he had a lot of links with Palestinian groups there. But that ended around 1983 when Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, started moving his fighters into northern Iraq to set the stage for their first attack on Turkey.
Don't the tensions in Turkey go all the way back to the 1920s when Turkey suppressed some Kurdish revolts? Were they in any way linked to what had been going on with the Armenians?
Well, Kurds, of course, lived in the same region where the Armenians were, and they were implicated in the massacres or the genocide against the Armenians, because they were fighters for the Ottomans at the same time. But afterwards, Turkish attention was placed on the Kurds, and there was an attempt after the formation of the state in 1923 to basically suppress Kurdish identity, sort of forcibly assimilate Kurds into becoming Turks, because the theory was we're all Muslims. We can all be Turks together. But Kurds resisted this, and there were intermittent rebellions through the late 1930s. And then even after that, there was always a sense of Kurdish nationalism among Kurds, even in stories they told their families or in the radio stations they listened to coming from Armenia or Iran or other places. But it wasn't until the 1970s that Kurds started to take up arms against the state.
And against each other, as you say. So violence has always been a part of this story. Would you describe the PKK as a guerrilla force or a terrorist group?
You know, I'm often asked that question by people from the Turkish embassy. And my answer is simply that it's not my job to define them. I think that's best left to policymakers. My job, as I see it in this book, is to explain the PKK, to give people the information they need to make their own decisions. So I describe everything from the internal executions to their killings of their rivals, to the fact that they have had and still do a great deal of support among average Kurds. But I'll leave the definition to others.
Well, who's been doing most of the damage, the Turkish government or the PKK? Because the death toll is pretty high, isn't it?
Death toll is around 40,000. But most of those people actually are Kurdish rebels. Most of the dead are Kurdish rebels. And after that would come Turkish soldiers and civilians. It's hard to say who's doing the most damage. Certainly the PKK, by its fight, has started off a sort of period of destruction in the region, but the Turkish military has reacted very harshly. They've forcibly evacuated villages. In the 1980s and 1990s, there were very, very credible allegations of human rights abuses, torture, extrajudicial executions, things that helped push Kurds towards the Turkish Kurdish rebel group.
So you're saying that if the Turkish government had been a little less repressive, a little more responsive to some Kurdish demands, perhaps this kind of conflict would not have escalated?
Certainly if they had tried to deal with these demands in the 60s and 70s, once the PKK started fighting, of course, it was hard for Turkey. The Turkish government always said it was difficult to make political concessions while the guerrillas were fighting. But what happened was that the leader of the group was captured in 1999 by Turkey, and the PKK called an open-ended ceasefire, basically suspended the war. That was a great chance for Turkey. It really could have gone in and made serious reforms, but it didn't, and that helped keep this problem alive and allowed the PKK to restart its war a few years ago and slowly gain more support again.
They also put that Kurdish leader on trial.
Right, the leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan.
And that seemed to exacerbate the situation.
It exacerbated, but at the same time, Abdullah Öcalan, when he was on trial, he essentially apologized for the war. He's not a very brave man in some ways, and he seemed to want to save his life. And he apologized and talked for and called for Turks and Kurds to work together peacefully. I think what happened was that many Kurds were dismayed. They were very shocked by what he said. And they were in a state of disarray looking for somebody to answer their problems. That, again, was a time when Turkey could have stepped in, but it didn't. And slowly people have forgotten what Öcalan said in his trial. And once again, the PKK is gaining popularity.
Alisa Marcus covered the PKK for more than 8 years, first as a freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and then later as a staff writer for Reuters News Agency. And she has now written a book called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, published by NYU Press. We will continue our conversation on today's backstory right after this. We're talking about the PKK on Backstory today with an expert in the field, Alisa Marcus, who's written a book called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, published by NYU Press. Was it your assignment, Alisa, as a reporter to specifically cover the war between Turkey and the PKK rebels?
It wasn't my specific assignment, but at the time I was one of the newest reporters there. I wasn't married. I had a lot of time on my hands, and I thought it was just a really interesting story because it was one that wasn't being covered that closely by the Western media. So whenever there was a chance, I went out to the southeast, to this Kurdish region, to try to report on the war.
And the rebel leaders were willing to talk to you more than to other Western journalists?
I don't know if they were willing to talk to me more. It was just that I was there. One time I went searching for Kurdish rebels in the region, ended up in a small village, and they offered to take me up into the mountains to meet their local commander. So I went with them, and he was pretty surprised, so was I, especially when the Turkish army started shelling the camp where we were, and I was stuck there for a couple of nights.
And you wound up speaking to former members of the PKK. Is that more useful?
In some ways it is, because the people who are in the group now obviously are very cautious. They're in an illegal organization. Many people are, the Turkish military is trying to capture them or kill them. And I think they're a little bit afraid to speak out independently, because the PKK is the sort of group that it's a very tightly controlled organization, and people can be and have been killed for criticizing the group. So I found that it was more effective to talk to people who had been inside the PKK, because they were still very proud of what they had done, but they were willing to talk very freely about their experiences.
What kind of people are recruited by the PKK?
The PKK recruits basically anybody. For the most part, it gets a lot of villagers, because much of Kurdish society is made up of villagers, people who, let's say, don't have, a university education, but they have lawyers, they have former political activists, journalists. Pretty much, they get a good cross-section of society.
And you said that villages were destroyed. I'm assuming that people whose villages were destroyed are more likely to join a group like the PKK.
Yes, of course, there was a real backlash from Turkish military operations, and it helped the PKK gain new recruits.
Have those villages ever come back?
The Turkish government has spoken about allowing villagers back, and in some parts of the region, some villagers have gone back. But one thing is that for the families who left the villages, they've been living in Istanbul and Ankara and other cities in Turkey. They have electricity, they have better schools, they have better opportunities. A lot of them just don't want to go back as well.
Have Iraqi Kurds joined the ranks of those fighting along the border with the Turkish troops?
Iraqi Kurds don't really join the PKK. They have their own mini-state right now that they're focused on. But what they do is they'll sell goods to the PKK. The Iraqi Kurdish villages will help resupply the group. But they generally stay out of the ranks.
Now, Turkey has had a secular government for most of its modern history, but earlier this year an Islamist was elected to be prime minister. What impact has that had on the tensions with the Kurds?
In some ways, it helped reduce tensions at the start, because the prime minister Tayyip Erdogan, who does have an Islamist background, had spoken about the Kurdish reality. In some ways, because of his Islamist background, he's less threatened by this idea of Kurdish nationalism, and he wanted to work things he said made it clear that he was interested in integrating Kurds better in Turkish society as Kurds. Unfortunately, because of the latest tensions, I think it'll make it difficult for the prime minister to move forward on any plans he might have had, because right now people in Turkey want some sort of armed reaction to what's been going on, and it's difficult to make political steps in that atmosphere.
Well, why have we seen this escalation of violence? 50 soldiers killed by the PKK over the past 2 months. If it's not related somehow to the new prime minister, is it just coincidental?
Part of it is coincidental. Of course, the PKK has rebels inside Turkey. Their job is to fight. When they come across a Turkish military patrol, they attack. That's what they do. At the same time, it's quite possible that the PKK has wanted to escalate things, that they want to get international attention, because they feel somehow that the Iraqi Kurds are getting all the attention, that from the outside, it looks like the Kurdish problem in the Middle East has been solved because the Iraqi Kurds have their own autonomous region now. And I think that the Turkish Kurdish rebel group wants to say to the world, no, we're still here. There's still another Kurdish problem.
Well, Jalal Talabani, the president of Iraq, is a Kurd who's been pushing for Kurdish rights for years. What does that mean for the PKK and relations with Turkey?
In some ways, for the PKK, it's given them somebody who is promoting the Kurdish issue internationally. But at the same time, the Iraqi president, Talabani, is really focused on the situation of Kurds inside Iraq. And he and Masoud Barzani, who's the president of the Kurdish region in northern Iraq, have spoken about the need for Turkey to solve its problem politically without military means. And I think for the PKK, this is good because there is another international leader speaking out for a solution to the Kurdish problem inside Turkey.
Well, Turkey has been pressing for the Iraqi government to cut off the PKK members, and the Kurdistani regional government has taken steps to block supplies to the rebels along the border. So I guess there is some kind of cooperation, but is it likely to have much impact?
No, it has very little impact, because even blocking the PKK rebels from getting supplies, it's difficult. It's a very long border. It's very mountainous. The Iraqi Kurdish government doesn't have enough soldiers to send up there and police it. So they can close some main checkpoints. They can make it very difficult for journalists, let's say, to go to the main PKK camp. They did close down a political party that was affiliated with the PKK. But for the most part, this will have very little effect on the Turkish Kurdish rebels because they can still operate freely in those mountains. It's almost impossible to stop it.
Didn't the Turkish government put you on trial in 1995?
Yes, they did, for an article I wrote about the Turkish military operations against villages, their attempts to depopulate the villages, to break the ties between PKK rebels and Kurds on the ground, which is a very common thing to do as a part of a counterinsurgency. It wasn't unique to Turkey at all.
And they dropped the charges. We've been seeing that happen quite regularly. Charges brought up against some of the most prominent writers in Turkey when they talk about the Armenian genocide. Is that government policy to put people on trial and then drop the charges after they've made their point?
I think part of it is that they put people on trial, as they did with myself, and then they get shocked at the international reaction and almost embarrassed. I think they get very surprised, and so they then just drop the charges when they realize that it's going to cause them more trouble than it's worth.
Although there are some people who suggest that an element within Turkey would like to see the international community reject Turkey because they don't want to be a part of the EU.
Yes, that's true. That is, there are definitely some groups inside Turkey who might like to see that. But I think it's important to remember also that the European Union is also sort of making it clear that it's not sure it wants Turkey. And this really helps strengthen any rejectionists inside Turkey, which is too bad.
My guest is Aliza Marcus. We're talking about the PKK. She's written a book about the PKK called Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, published by NYU Press. What was the outcome of the state visit by Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan to the White House earlier this month?
He apparently received a promise from the United States that the U.S. would provide real-time intelligence from that border region to the Turkish government or Turkish military. And the hope on the Turkish side is that this will allow them to track the PKK rebels better and launch assaults against them. One question is, how good is the U.S. intelligence in that region? Again, it's very mountainous. The rebels know the area. There are a lot of caves, a lot of deep valleys. You know, there's a question of what can you actually see from the air.
Isn't that where all those weapons of mass destruction have been hidden?
That, if they are, maybe it's worth going there.
U.S. intelligence hasn't always been very good in the region, I guess. So where do things stand now between the PKK and the Turkish government? Is there any sign that Turkey will pull back the 100,000 troops that they've stationed on the border?
There's no real sign that they're going to pull back their troops, but there's reason to believe that they might. One simple reason is that the weather gets very bad soon, and it really snows. It's hard to operate in those mountains in the winter. It's usually a time of an unofficial ceasefire between the Turkish military and the PKK. So I think it would be difficult for Turkey to stage a large ground assault right at this moment. Of course, part of this depends on the PKK. If the PKK stages some sort of raid that kills a lot of Turkish soldiers just along the border with Iraq, it would be more difficult for the Turkish military not to react.
Why did the Turkish government try last week to ban another Kurdish party, the Democratic Society Party? Do they have links to the PKK?
The Turkish government claims there are links to the PKK, but the truth is that the Kurdish political party doesn't have organic links. Inside the party are people who like the PKK, who sympathize with the PKK, and people who want to operate as independent Kurdish politicians, but they do have a nationalist agenda, or an agenda that would like to see Kurdish ethnic identity officially recognized inside Turkey. And there's always a tension inside the party between these two groups. I think one question is whether banning the party makes sense. What sort of platform does that give Kurds if they don't have a political party operating on their behalf?
The Turkish government seems to move back and forth in this way, kind of strong-arming people and then pulling back. That's why I was asking about dropping charges. It hasn't been all that effective over the years. Why do they continue doing this?
They don't have a real Kurdish policy. The Turkish government really is still reacting in a way. It just wants to stamp out the problem. So it opens cases against this Kurdish political party. The party is shut down, and then it reopens with the same people, but under a different name. This has been going on for years. Similarly, the Turkish government insists that there's a military solution to this problem, that the PKK can be beaten back militarily. Well, it hasn't happened yet, and the PKK has been active fighting since 1984. So I think one issue is that successive Turkish governments have yet to come up with a coherent policy on how to deal with the Kurds. And so they're basically trying to make the problem go away rather than solve it.
Do you think that if they gave the area some autonomy and allowed people to speak the Kurdish language, that the PKK would lose a lot of its support?
I think the PKK would certainly be weakened, but I think one issue is that groups like the PKK, and we see this throughout the world, they need to be somehow integrated into a solution. A lot of Kurds have or had relatives in the group. They gave money. They were forced out of their villages because they supported the group. The group needs some sort of way to be integrated into a solution, but I think it's certainly possible that you could demand that the PKK re-enter politics as, let's say, as a nonviolent group, and it would concede that. But I'm not sure that that's something that Turkey can accept.
On Monday, journalists were banned by the regional government from traveling to Kurdish rebel bases in Iraq because they claim the media are aggravating the crisis with Turkey. So is that an indication that the situation is starting to cool down?
I think it's an indication that the Iraqi Kurds really would like to sideline this problem for a while and keep the PKK quiet so as to make it more difficult for the Turkish army to cross the border and attack PKK rebel bases, which, of course, would be incredibly destabilizing to Iraqi Kurdistan, which is the one quiet place in Iraq right now. So So I think it's a good sign. I think the Iraqi Kurds are trying to lower tension, and hopefully this is something that Turkey will respect.
Well, just today, American General David Petraeus and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff met with Turkish military officials to discuss how to flush the PKK out of northern Iraq. Is that also tacit consent for the Turkish military to continue its incursions across the border?
No, I think it's probably less tacit consent than an attempt to sort of control the situation and stop Turkey from launching an enormous cross-border raid, which I think the U.S. is very much afraid of. The question comes again back to, is it possible to push the PKK rebels out of those mountains? And remember, the Turkish military has been trying to do this for decades. At times, they've even had Iraqi Kurds fighting on their behalf, and nobody has succeeded.
Now, if they push too hard, will they alienate the Iraqi Kurds?
Yes, definitely. And that's very dangerous. And it's something also that's dangerous for the United States, because if the United States is seen as helping Turkey attack the PKK, they could get a negative response from the Iraqi Kurds, who have been a strong ally of the United States until now.
On the other hand, if the PKK were to lose their foothold in Iraq, where would their leaders go?
They really don't have any place to go. They used to be able to use Iranian territory, but that ended after Öcalan's capture, the capture of the PKK leader. They could put down their weapons and sort of melt into the Iraqi Kurdish cities, but that is something they would be unlikely to want to do. They could try to survive in Turkey, but it would be difficult for them.
Has any major Turkish politician come up with a plan to integrate the Kurds?
Former President Turgut Özal, who was the president of Turkey in the early 1990s, did appear to have some sort of plan. It was something he was working on, but then he died of a heart attack in 1993 before he could really move forward on this. There have been plans put forward by business associations, by some politicians, but there's been no official government high-level plan to integrate Kurds and recognize their ethnic identity, because that's the issue. Kurds are integrated into Turkish society if they don't promote their identity. They're in the government, they're in businesses. You can't really tell a Kurd from a Turk. The problem is Kurds who want to identify themselves as Kurds and want equal rights, minority rights as Kurds.
Now, we have very little time, but I was wondering if the PKK could continue to exist if their terms were met. Do they feed off the chaos and the unrest?
They certainly feed off the chaos and unrest to a certain extent, but I think that if there were true peace and if that the PKK could continue as a political group, if you're asking if they could continue as a rebel force, it's more difficult. When they're not fighting, it's difficult for them to maintain support, get new recruits, get money, because they don't have a clear goal or a clear action at that point. But for 4 years, they didn't fight between 1999 and 2004, 5 years almost, and they still managed to maintain themselves.
Aliza Marcus's book is Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. It is published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for participating in Backstory today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
On tomorrow's show, we reveal the results of our Thanksgiving cartoon contest. New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff has chosen the winners, and he'll be here tomorrow to help us get into the Thanksgiving spirit. Also, I'll talk to a man who suddenly inherited several million dollars and then had to decide what to do with it. Also, Norman Lloyd, who's worked with Alfred Hitchcock, Orson Welles, and Martin Scorsese, among others. Plus, your calls to Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Paula Crossfield, and Stephanie Hughes. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.